You're listening to So Speaks, a different kind of podcast where each week we discuss everything and anything that matters. No boundaries, no limitations, just real conversations, real stories, and real facts.
What's up, guys? Sona here, and I'm back. It's been a really, really long time. I don't really have any excuse other than that I was working, and it was kind of hard to juggle everything together. I also wanted to give it a few weeks to see if there would be any more information that would pop up regarding Jeffrey Epstein, but that turned into a few months, and I have some updates, but not many. This case has kind of disappeared. I wouldn't say disappeared because some people are still talking about it, but it does seem that it has been swept under the rug a little bit. But I'm back with part two, so as usual.
Let's get into it.
So in my last episode, I mentioned how I would be talking about the charges that were brought against Alfredo Rodriguez, who was Jeffrey Epstein's butler, aka house manager. And these charges were brought against him by the FBI. But before we get into that, I do want to mention some developments that have occurred since I recorded my episode. And these developments involve the prison guards that were supposed to be checking on Jeffrey Epstein the day he committed suicide. So that's what we're going to talk about now, and then I'll get back into Alfredo Rodriguez's case. So the two prison guards that were on duty the night that Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide were indicted. They did not complete the mandated checks that they were supposed to complete that night at the prison, at the jail, sorry, and that includes the other inmates. So they just didn't check on inmates at all. And apparently they were napping during that time. But I think we can all agree that we can put napping in inverted commas. So more specifically, they were indicted for allegedly ignoring over 75 mandatory checks on Jeffrey Epstein, then fabricating records to cover it up. So their official charges are multiple counts of falsifying records and conspiracy, and they both pleaded not guilty. According to the video surveillance footage obtained by prosecutors, Epstein was in his cell unobserved for 8 hours before he was found dead, as opposed to being checked on 2 times an hour. And he was high risk for suicide, and yet they still didn't check on him. And the video is missing. Like, let's go over this, okay? So the night he commits suicide, the guards happen to be napping or not checking up on none of the inmates, him included, yet he's high risk for suicide. Apparently they were online shopping. They're supposed to check on him 2 times an hour. They didn't do that. And then the video from that night that he committed suicide just happens to go missing. I mean, at this point, you know, it's almost ridiculous how hard they're not even trying to cover this up. But because he committed suicide, the records from his 2015 conviction are still sealed, and his co-conspirators from that conviction are still being protected because their names haven't been revealed and they're not unsealing those documents, which makes you wonder, who are they protecting? Clearly, if they haven't unsealed the records, that means there's something in those documents that would affect people that are still here today, that are still relevant today, because there would be no other reason. If everything that was in those documents was linked only to Jeffrey Epstein, which we know they're not, and weren't relevant, you know, if he was no longer here, if he was dead, then they would have unsealed them. But clearly, there's something in those documents that affects people that are still here today, that are still in society today, that they don't want us to see. I mean, it's not even a conspiracy. It's just common sense. There's literally no other reason for them not to unseal those documents, which is crazy. It's actually even crazier when you think about his circle, because it's not like he was just socializing with just anyone. He was socializing with people that were prominent members of society, the 1%. So if he had co-conspirators, it's not that much of a stretch, as I mentioned in the last episode, it's not that much of a stretch to assume that the people in those documents are the people that he was hanging out with. So, you know, when you add it together, it's very interesting. Okay, so enough waffling on my part. We'll get to the conspiracies because there are many. I mean, I don't personally think that they're just conspiracy theories, but anyway, let's talk about Alfredo Rodriguez, the butler. So Alfredo Rodriguez, aka the butler, aka the house manager, got into a lot of trouble with the FBI in 2009 because of this famous little black book of Epstein's. Now, the information that I'm getting is from the declassified FBI files, and in true FBI fashion, a lot of the information has been redacted. So I kind of had to fill in the blank from the research that I have been doing. So on October 28th, 2009, Rodriguez was served with a subpoena to provide any and all documents relating to the case. Now, the case that is referenced in this file, in this FBI file, is referring to, obviously, the case against Jeffrey Epstein, but it actually goes further back than that. The FBI had been compiling a case against Jeffrey Epstein based off of one of his victims suing him in 2008. And what happened was Alfredo Rodriguez attempted to sell these documents to the lawyer of the victim. And the lawyer of the victim ended up ratting him out to the FBI, which is how the FBI ended up talking to him and arresting him. And he was actually convicted for obstruction of justice. But the information around Alfredo Rodriguez and his involvement is very interesting. But what people don't realize is that this whole Jeffrey Epstein mess goes back years. And he's actually settled with a lot of victims out of court, meaning he gave them money. But this goes back to 2005, to the first victim that sued him. And I realized in my research that this could be confusing for a lot of people. For me as well. And what the Miami Herald did was they compiled a timeline that explains everything from the beginning until his suicide. And I think that the timeline fills in a lot of the blanks. I think it would be useful to go over the timeline before we get into more detail on Alfredo Rodriguez's involvement. Not to mention the fact that this FBI file is over 90 pages long, and there's a lot of information in there. And wait until you find out who had this document sealed. It's so insane how everything comes back together, and that's when you start to realize. But I'm gonna go over the timeline because I think that it's important to really understand this whole Jeffrey Epstein situation, and then we'll get back to Alfredo Rodriguez. Now, all the way back in March 2005, a 14-year-old girl and her parents report that Jeffrey Epstein molested her at a mansion in Palm Beach. She said a female acquaintance and classmate at Royal Palm Beach High School had taken her to the house to give him a massage in exchange for money. April 2005. Palm Beach police begin trash pulls at Epstein's home, discovering a telephone message for Epstein with the girl's name on it and a time that matched the time that she told police she was there. They find the names and phone numbers of other girls on message slips in his trash. October 2005. With the police probe in full swing, one of Epstein's assistants calls one of the girls just as she is being questioned by police. Investigators begin interviewing more girls, as well as Epstein's butlers, who tell them that Epstein had frequent visits from girls throughout the day. On October 20th, they execute a search warrant at his house on El Brillo Way in Palm Beach. 2006, May. Police sign a probable cause affidavit charging Epstein and two of his assistants with multiple counts of unlawful sex acts with a minor. The Palm Beach State Attorney, Barry Krischer, instead refers the case to a grand jury. June. The grand jury, after hearing from only one girl, returns an indictment of one count of solicitation of prostitution. The charge does not reflect that the victim in question and others were minors. July, Epstein's powerhouse legal team tries to negotiate a deal with the state attorney's office. Lawyers discuss a deferred prosecution in which Epstein would enter a pretrial intervention program and serve no jail time. July, after pressure from the Palm Beach police chief, the FBI opens a federal investigation dubbed Operation Leap Year. Documents list the possible crime as child prostitution. November, the FBI begins interviewing potential witnesses and victims from Florida, New York, and New Mexico. 2007, May. As the U.S. Attorney's Office prepares to present the case to a federal grand jury, Epstein's attorneys request a meeting to discuss the investigation. June. A 53-page indictment is prepared by the U.S. Attorney's Office as simultaneously plea negotiations are initiated with Epstein's legal team. July. Grand jury subpoenas are issued for Epstein's computers, which were apparently removed from his Palm Beach home prior to the police search. August, the U.S. attorney in Miami, Alexander Acosta, enters into direct discussions about the plea agreement. A motion to compel production of Epstein's computers is delayed. September, federal prosecutors draw up several federal plea agreements that are rejected by Epstein and his attorneys. Epstein signs a non-prosecution agreement on September 24th, but his attorneys continue to delay his court appearance. October, with the non-prosecution agreement still being debated, Acosta meets with Epstein lawyer Jay Lefkowitz at the West Palm Beach Marriott on Okeechobee Boulevard to discuss finalizing a deal. Among the terms agreed upon, that the victims would not be notified, that the deal would be kept under seal, and all grand jury subpoenas would be canceled. November, Epstein's lawyers object to an addendum to the agreement. The provision called for a special master to appoint an attorney to represent Epstein victims' rights to civil compensation. December, the two sides continue to debate the addendum. Epstein attorney Kenneth Starr asks for a review of the agreement by the U.S. Department of Justice in Washington, further delaying its execution. Victims are told the investigation is continuing. 2008, January. Epstein attorney Lefkowitz calls Acosta, telling him his client will not go through with the agreement because it requires him to register as a sex offender. February. With the plea negotiations and the Justice Department review still in limbo, the FBI continues its probe, locating more witnesses and evidence. March. Preparations are made for a new federal grand jury presentation. In court documents, the U.S. Attorney's Office notes that Epstein's victims are being harassed by his lawyers, who are not specifically named. May. The Justice Department issues finding that if a plea deal is not reached, Epstein can be federally prosecuted. June. Epstein's lawyers revisit plea negotiations, and on June 30th, Epstein appears in a Palm Beach County courtroom. He pleads guilty to state charges, one count of solicitation of prostitution, and one count of solicitation of prostitution with a minor under the age of 18. He is sentenced to 18 months in jail, followed by a year of community control or house arrest. He is adjudicated as a convicted sex offender who must register twice a year in Florida. July. Epstein's victims learn about his plea in state court after the fact. They file an emergency petition to force federal prosecutors to comply with the Federal Crime Victims' Rights Act, which mandates certain rights for crime victims, including the right to be informed about plea agreements and the right to appear at sentencing. August. Epstein's victims learn that he has already been sent to jail and that the federal investigation is over. They seek to have his plea agreement unsealed, but federal prosecutors argue against releasing the agreement, commencing a year-long court battle to learn the terms of Epstein's plea bargain. October, Epstein begins work release from the county stockade. He is picked up by his private driver 6 days a week and transported to an office in West Palm Beach, where he accepts visitors for up to 12 hours a day. He returns to the stockade in the evenings to sleep. And now we have arrived in 2009, just prior to the FBI being contacted by, or contacting rather, Alfredo Rodriguez. So July 2009, Epstein is released from the Palm Beach County stockade 5 months early. He must register as a sex offender and is on probation for a year, confined to his Palm Beach home, except to travel to his office in West Palm Beach. However, records show he frequently makes trips to Manhattan and to his home in the U.S. Virgin Islands. August, Palm Beach Police Captain George Frick finds Epstein walking along A1A in the middle of the afternoon when he was supposed to be at work in his office in downtown West Palm Beach. Epstein says he is walking to work even though the location where he is found is not a direct route to his office. His probation officer says Epstein has permission to get some exercise. September, the federal non-prosecution agreement is made public. By September, at least a dozen civil lawsuits have been filed by women who allege they were molested by Epstein when they were younger. Epstein begins the process of settling them out of court. November is when we come to Alfredo Rodriguez. November 2009, one of Epstein's former butlers tries to sell to an undercover FBI agent a black book filled with the names of hundreds of girls and young women that Epstein allegedly procured for sex and massages. The butler tells FBI agents he witnessed nude underage girls at Epstein's pool and had known that the millionaire was having sex with them. He also said he saw pornography involving underage girls on Epstein's computers. The butler slash houseman, Alfredo Rodriguez, is later charged with obstruction of justice and sentenced to federal prison. He dies in 2015. The contents of the Black Book become public as part of several civil lawsuits. So quickly, just to clarify, here in the timeline, it mentions that he tried to sell the info to an undercover FBI agent. In the declassified files, they have an account that mentions what I said earlier about him trying to sell the info to the victim's lawyer. So I assume that once the lawyer told the FBI, they conducted some sort of sting operation. Either that or the information in the article is incorrect, because in the FBI declassified files, it specifically mentions that he tried to sell the information to the lawyer, to the victim's lawyer. So I'm assuming it could have been both. Now, this is where it gets weird. So during the civil litigation against Jeffrey Epstein, well, we can assume that it was Jeffrey Epstein because it's redacted in this FBI document. But knowing what we know now, we know that it was a civil case against Jeffrey Epstein. It started with one of his victims and it ended up being a lot more. So the law firm that was representing these victims wanted to interview a federal inmate as being a potential witness against Jeffrey Epstein. And you might be thinking, what does that have to do with him abusing young girls? Well, this inmate apparently, through correspondence with, and then it's redacted, so we don't know who he was talking to, claimed to have information regarding, now it's redacted, I'm just going to go ahead and say Jeffrey Epstein, being involved in the murder of a Columbus, Ohio attorney named Arthur L. Shapiro, who was killed on March 6, 1985 in the Columbus area. The case, at the time of this document, 2009-2010, was unsolved. Now, 2020, this case is still unsolved. So from 1985 to now, this case has never been solved. You might be thinking, well, how do you know the information is about Jeffrey Epstein? Well, I'm going to explain. But it's very interesting because you might be wondering, what does this have to do with Jeffrey Epstein? But more importantly, what does this have to do with his butler, Alfredo Rodriguez? Well, Alfredo Rodriguez, in this document, mentioned to the lawyer that he tried to sell the black book to, that he had information as well. In the document that I'm looking at, it specifically says information. It doesn't say documents. And I know that documents can be information, but we're not going to play semantics. He saw a lot, so we can assume that he did also hear things. So he tried to sell information to the lawyer. And I think that's why the lawyer wanted to have the inmate as a witness. Okay? Bear with me because this gets even crazier. So from what I gather from looking at all of this information is that Alfredo Rodriguez knew a lot more about Jeffrey Epstein than simply the girls that he was abusing. And I'm not saying simply to minimize what they went through, but it just seems that there is a lot more to this than him abusing young girls. He was involved in a lot more, okay? So after the FBI found out about the inmate and the connection to Arthur Shapiro's murder, they went to interview him. He refused to speak to them without a lawyer. I'm assuming they went back because there's a section that says the lead is closed. They did not include the interview, but they did interview him. After that interview, there was an interest in two other inmates. One of them, the name was completely redacted. The FBI files, as you have gathered, are very ambiguous. Either a lot of it is redacted or there are parts of it that are missing. For these two inmates, they just wanted information on their cases. One of them, as I mentioned, was redacted. The other one was Barry Lester Kessler, who was an associate, a business associate of Arthur Shapiro, but also a convicted murderer. He, however, at this time was deceased, but they took an interest to his case. There was speculation prior that he was somehow involved in Arthur Shapiro's death. But the interesting part about this is that his files are sealed. I did, however, manage to find an article that was talking about him and his case. Barry Lester Kessler was a Columbus, Ohio accountant who was involved in some very shady things. Not only was he in trouble with the law for tax-related offenses, he was a suspect in multiple murder-for-hire plots dating back to 1970 and all people he was in business with somehow. He was convicted of murder in 1997 for the murder of John DeRue and sentenced to death in the state of Florida. He had taken out an insurance policy, a life insurance policy on John DeRue, and that seemed to be his MO. All the murders that he was suspected of somehow involved life insurance policies. But in 1999, the Supreme Court of Florida overturned his conviction. But in 2005, he was sentenced to life once again in prison in the state of Florida for the murder of John DeRue. So he was finally rightfully convicted, but no longer sentenced to death. And he died 6 months later at the age of 84. But what is the link to Shapiro? Well, Kessler was a suspect in the murder of Shapiro. Why? Because before Shapiro's murder, both him and Kessler were both under investigation by the IRS. Shapiro was being investigated for failure to pay his income tax and was scheduled to give testimony before a federal grand jury right before his murder. Kessler was under investigation for helping Shapiro create false tax shelters. And the reason they suspected Kessler of Shapiro's murder is because they were both seen meeting with the same man right before Shapiro was murdered. So they assume that Kessler is the one that orchestrated this hit because it was a mafia-style murder against Shapiro. Okay, but now you're probably still going to ask me, well, what does this have to do with Jeffrey Epstein? Don't worry, I'm getting there. So as you can guess, they never had any evidence to charge Kessler for Shapiro's murder. And unfortunately, if he did do it, he got away with it and he ended up passing away in prison. So all these years later, why is the FBI looking into a 1985 cold case file as well as wanting to speak to another inmate regarding this murder, but in relation to a civil case against Jeffrey Epstein? Firstly, I would like to add one theory, and this is my theory that I have regarding why they wanted to speak to the inmate. Sorry, I meant the inmate that they requested information on, not the inmate that they interviewed or wanted to interview. Personally, I think that they wanted to revisit Kessler's other associations. Because in the FBI files, they specifically mentioned that the assistant United States attorney in Columbus, Ohio, when asked, was unsure whether there was a third co-defendant in the tax fraud case. So it's possible that another person was involved, and that's why the FBI was requesting information. And who could that third person be? Not a stretch to assume that they could have a hypothesis on who the third person is, right? Now, do I think it's Jeffrey Epstein? Personally, no, I don't think it's Jeffrey Epstein, but I think it's someone that Jeffrey Epstein knows very well. And I know this is frustrating, but it's a lot of information. But I'm gonna explain everything and then I'm gonna do a recap of it all so it makes sense and the connections make sense, because obviously that's important. But just to solidify what I said earlier about Alfredo Rodriguez having information, in the FBI file are email exchanges between Alfredo Rodriguez and someone else. And that someone else, I think, is the lawyer who he wanted to sell the documents and the information to, because the reply email mentions something about a deposition, which is obviously a legal term. So I think that Alfredo Rodriguez was emailing this lawyer, and in one of the emails, he says, I have the information that you asked for. So personally, this is how I see the link between Shapiro all the way to Jeffrey Epstein. Alfredo Rodriguez had information regarding Shapiro's murder. That's what I believe. And I think that's why the FBI got involved. It could be that Alfredo Rodriguez heard something involving Shapiro. And honestly, when you find out who I think the link is, it'll make sense. And I'm not trying to build suspense. I just want to make sure that I cover all the bases. But after that, there's not much more in the FBI file. There are letters, however, that are asking for it to be sealed. The name is redacted, but it turned out that it was Acosta who asked for the documents to be sealed. And Acosta, for those of you that don't know or don't remember, was Trump's labor secretary. So ultimately, Alfredo Rodriguez ended up serving 18 months in prison for obstruction of justice. Jeffrey Epstein ended up pretty much getting away with everything that he did up until obviously the recent arrest and his suicide, but we're still not there yet. So now we can talk about how Jeffrey Epstein is connected to Shapiro, well, indirectly connected to Shapiro. What is the link between Shapiro's murder, Alfredo Rodriguez, Jeffrey Epstein? It's not what is the link, but it's who is the link. So just to recap for those who might be confused or overwhelmed by the information that I gave. Alfredo Rodriguez was Jeffrey Epstein's butler. He was fired by Epstein. He had documents and information that he stole on Jeffrey Epstein, including a black book filled with the names of Jeffrey Epstein's associates, as well as the names of his victims. He tried to sell all of this to the lawyer representing a victim of Epstein's in order to be used in a civil case against him. Okay, but the lawyer informed the FBI that Alfredo Rodriguez was attempting to sell information on Jeffrey Epstein. The FBI then subpoenaed Alfredo Rodriguez to hand over everything he had to them. He refused. He also mentioned how everything he had was insurance for his life, basically to protect himself. Somehow during all of this, the FBI began looking into Arthur Shapiro's murder and its connection to Jeffrey Epstein. I believe it's because Alfredo Rodriguez claimed to have information that indirectly or directly connected Jeffrey Epstein to the murder somehow. Okay, but that's not made clear in the documents. A lot of it was redacted. So the FBI also requested information on Barry Lester Kessler and another inmate whose name is redacted. Barry Lester Kessler is relevant because he was a business associate of Shapiro's and a convicted murderer. Both of them were being investigated right before Shapiro's death. So I think that the inmate whose name was redacted in the FBI file could have been the state witness that was used against Barry Lester Kessler during his trial. But, you know, I'm not sure about that. And there's no evidence to say that that's the case. That's just my theory. But I also believe that the FBI looked into this case more because there may have been a third co-defendant. So it could be that there was another person that was being investigated for tax evasion along with Arthur Shapiro and Barry Lester Kessler. And do I think that that person is Jeffrey Epstein? No, but it could be. But also it could be a close associate of Epstein's. I can't tell you for certain who that associate is, but I can tell you that after some digging, it turns out that there is one person that knew all three of them, okay? And so the person that links Arthur Shapiro, Barry Lester Kessler, and Jeffrey Epstein is Columbus, Ohio billionaire Les Wexner. Now, I'm not accusing him of anything, but he is the link between the three of them. And Ohio police seem to think that he was relevant enough to talk about in their case on Arthur Shapiro. So who is Les Wexner? So Les Wexner is an American businessman. He is the founder and chairman of L Brands Incorporated, formerly known as Limited Brands, which is a giant American retailer based in Columbus, Ohio. Now, for those of you who don't know, Limited Brands currently owns Victoria's Secret, Bath & Body Works, and owned Abercrombie & Fitch, Express, La Senza, etc. So according to Columbus police, in their Shapiro murder file document, Shapiro's murder occurred one day prior to Shapiro's scheduled appearance before a grand jury, and there was some conjecture that Shapiro was in a position to provide information that would have been damaging to some other party. Thus, while the motive remains unclear, the suspect is an individual who A, knew Shapiro and had some personal professional contact with him, B, would benefit from his death or from ensuring his silence, and C, had close contact with LCN figures or trusted LCN associates. LCN is La Cosa Nostra, which is the mafia organization, and D, had the personal financial resources to afford the cost of the contract hit. Okay, so most of that we know from the FBI file, but what I find interesting is this link to a specific mafia organization, and it gets even more interesting. They go on to say that from their research, it appears that Les Wexner had established contact with associates reputed to be organized crime figures, one of whom was a major major investment partner and another was using the limited headquarters as a mailing address. It is not known whether there are other such figures among Wexner associates, but it can be hypothesized that the Genovesi La Rocca crime families might consider Wexner a friend. Like Arthur Shapiro was, Wexner is considered a very secretive, very private person, and little is known about the business transactions that might raise questions of ethics and legality. For example, while it cannot be proved, it is hypothesized that WNK partnership was an investment of Wexner and Kessler in Jerry Hammond's jazz club, hoping to influence favorable zoning and annexation considerations for Wexley. At the very least, there would be some question of ethics in the transaction. Now, just to clarify, I know you probably heard the name Kessler and thought, oh wait, is that the same Kessler that I mentioned earlier? No, it's not. In this document, it's a John Kessler, whereas I was talking about Barry Kessler. However, both are from Ohio, so it doesn't mention whether there's any relation, but I think there was. But I can't prove it just yet. I might have to do some more digging. So to continue, while transactions such as this would be questionable for homicide, it is transactions such as this and business associates with organized crime ties that lead to a question of ethics and legality of other unknown transactions and associates with which Wexner may be involved. While there is no question of ethics or legality on the surface, it is noted that some business organizations and individuals have co-located and become submerged without merging with Wexner and his varied business interests. Most notable is Stanley Schwartz and the large Schwartz, Kelm, Warren, and Rubenstein law firm. It is not clear, for example, why Stanley Schwartz would join the board of Omni Oil with Les Wexner, whether or not the law firm represents the Limited. While the Limited would be an important client, the large law firm seems to remain independent of corporate bondage. Thus, the concluding hypothesis is that Arthur Shapiro could have answered too many of these sorts of questions and might have been forced to answer them in his impending grand jury hearing. Stanley Schwartz might now be able to answer some of the same questions for the same reason, but does not face a grand jury. He is immersed in the pattern himself and now has a powerful incentive to maintain discretion. So essentially what they're saying is that Les Wexner was involved in some shady things. Arthur Shapiro knew a lot about his business transactions, and apparently Shapiro's murder would give incentive for anyone to be quiet, right? However, they don't have any proof that Les Wexner was involved. Now, this document is from 1991. The Shapiro murder is still open, and they still haven't found who did it. So what is the link with Jeffrey Epstein? Les Wexner and Jeffrey Epstein had a very close business and personal relationship. So let's look into that. Wexner and Jeffrey Epstein's relationship began in the 1980s. He was Jeffrey Epstein's primary billionaire client, and in 1987, Epstein became Wexner's financial manager. In 91, Wexner granted Epstein power of attorney and also instated him as a trustee on the board of the Wexner Foundation. So clearly, he trusted Jeffrey Epstein. That being said, after Epstein was charged in Florida in 2006 with multiple counts of molestation and unlawful sexual activity with a minor and went to prison, Wexner reportedly cut ties. And in August 2009, after Epstein's second incarceration and just before his death, Wexner addressed the Wexner Foundation by letter, telling them everything about his dealings, supposedly with Epstein, and stating that his former financial advisor, Epstein, had misappropriated vast sums of money from him and from his family. So basically accusing Jeffrey Epstein of stealing his money. Ever since then, Wexner has kind of also stepped down from his position, which is interesting. So what do we know? We know that Jeffrey Epstein was very close with Les Wexner. We know that the FBI was looking into Shapiro's murder in relation to Jeffrey Epstein. The only link between Jeffrey Epstein and Shapiro is Les Wexner. And we know that the Ohio police mentioned Les Wexner specifically in relation to that murder. They don't name him as a suspect, but they say that it wouldn't be a stretch for him to be a suspect because Shapiro worked for him and he has ties to the mafia. Now, it's hard to put the pieces together because a lot of the FBI file was redacted. You know, it was also specifically in Alfredo Rodriguez's file, which means that somehow Alfredo Rodriguez is involved. What I think is, as I mentioned, is that Alfredo Rodriguez had information on that murder. He may have overheard something, he may have seen something, he may have read something that talked about Shapiro's murder and linked it somehow to Jeffrey Epstein and I think Les Wexner, because that's the only link that there is between Shapiro and Jeffrey Epstein. It's Les Wexner, okay? Which that might be an episode alone in itself. But when I started this episode, I didn't expect this rabbit hole, I will be honest. It's kind of taken a turn into this rabbit hole that I didn't even think that I would go down. So I decided that I'm going to make a separate episode on Shapiro's murder in and of itself. But what I was going to do was talk about Jeffrey Epstein's supposed link to intelligence, because there's that aspect as well. I won't be doing that in this episode, so I'm going to have to make a part three where I talk more about the Black Book, which I haven't forgotten. Talking about Les Wexner is actually a good segue into talking about the Black Book, because the Black Book has the names of the alleged abusers in it circled. And initially, I had thought that the names were circled by Jeffrey Epstein, but in fact, the reason why Alfredo Rodriguez was investigated so much and was essentially the key to everything was because he was the one that annotated the Black Book. So he knew a lot. He definitely knew a lot. So in part three, we're going to look into the Black Book. This time, I promise we will. The names that were circled without me getting sued. And then also Jeffrey Epstein's ties, supposed ties with intelligence. Then hopefully we will finally get to the conclusion and decide whether we think Jeffrey Epstein was murdered or not. The more research I do, the more digging I do, I'm going to have to lean towards yes, because there are a lot of people who would be very unhappy, a lot of powerful people that would be very unhappy if everything Jeffrey Epstein knew came to light. And from what I gather about him, I think he was a coward, and I think that he would have sang and told everything, because I see him as the type of person that wouldn't want to go down alone. And I think that there are a lot of powerful people that can't have that, just looking at his friends and looking at his circle. But as I said, in part three, we will go into that more deeply. So until then, I have to say thank you for listening. I'm sorry it took so long for this episode to come out. Hope you enjoyed it. I hope it wasn't too confusing and all over the place. And take care of yourselves, and I'll see you next time. Bye.